Confronting racism directly is a challenge. However, looking frankly at more latent yet pervasive ways that racism shapes the world around us can be equally difficult. Austin Channing Brown's book, I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness, offers a powerful perspective on race and systemic racism. Her firsthand account of growing up black and Christian in middle-class white America highlights the intricacies that allow racist systems to be perpetuated. From centering conversations about racism on white feelings to being mistaken for a client rather than an employee at a nonprofit organization, Brown seeks to face the difficult conversations about race head-on, and we are thrilled that she's able to join us today. Welcome.
I'm so glad to be here.
I mean, I think before we get to there's so much in this book. I think the best place to start would be your name. How did you uncover how your parents decided on your name? And how old were you when you figured this out?
Yeah, so I was about 8, and I was very used to people assuming that I would be a boy, because my name is Austin. And I went to the library one day and gave the librarian my little card, very excited about checking out my books. And she was like, "Is this your card?" And I said, "Yeah, pretty sure. Like, it could be my mom's, could be my brother's, but I think it's mine." She said, "This card says Austin." I said, "Well, yeah, that's me. I'm Austin." And she asked me if I was sure. And I thought, am I sure I'm Austin? Like, I don't understand the question. What are you talking about? And I got so annoyed. I walked over to my mother and said, "Ma, why did you give me this name?" And she started to tell me about our family history and where my name comes from. I said, "Ma, I know where it comes from. I'm asking you, why did you choose it?" And she said, "Austin, we knew that if we gave you this name, if people didn't see you, if they just saw it like written down, they would assume you're a white man. And one day you're gonna have interviews. You're gonna like fill out a college application. You're gonna have job applications. And we just wanted to make sure you made it to the interview."
I mean, there's been so many studies that have been done in recent years where somebody puts in their name, and then, you know, maybe the name is not seen necessarily as a white American name. And right. Then puts in a quote unquote white name, and you see that the white name with the same exact resume gets seen more. So what can a typical job interview process look and feel like for you?
Well, usually it starts with surprise.
Yeah.
Usually someone comes out and says, "Are you," like, they're not even sure how to phrase the question.
Right.
Are you here for the interview? Right? I'm like, "Yes, I'm the next interview. My name is Austin." And they're like, "Oh, okay." And I think it's really funny because they're wondering whether or not they accidentally invited the black girl instead of the white guy, right?
Right.
And so then I get into the interview, and if there are more people there, they typically look at me, and then they look at my resume, and then they look at each other, and then they look back at me. They're like trying to figure out, should we have known?
Right. I mean, how often does it matter? Like, how often do you get a look? I mean, the surprise, I understand, but do you ever have a look of maybe disappointment, or have you ever felt like, "Oh, great, I thought this was a job I was up for"?
Interview situation.
Okay.
In an interview situation, I think because I usually apply to pretty progressive spaces,
sure,
people are
sure
usually happy, right?
Right.
Where it gets me into trouble more often is when I'm teaching. And so let's say there's just like some announcement that someone named Austin is going to be teaching the class. And then, you know, some folks show up and get a little surprised that the expert is not a white man.
Right. I mean, what kind of work can be attached to being one of a handful of people of color at an organization?
Oh, man. My primary word is exhausting.
Yeah.
It's so exhausting. I mean, gotta love white people, but sometimes just, you know, a little exhausting.
Are the phones ringing yet? Okay. You use the word white people on public radio, we might get some calls.
I know. I'm sorry. if you enjoyed it, you should buy the book. If you did not like that, you should probably just stay away.
you know, you talk a lot about your childhood, you know, of course, being formative. What was the significance of spending summers in Cleveland for you after your parents divorced?
Oh, it was so hard at first. So my mom moved to an all-Black community, and it's the first time I had ever been in an all-Black space where I was just one of the majority. And it was wonderful, but it was also terrifying because there was so much I didn't know about, like, pop culture. So I remember the most popular conversation that first summer was whether or not Whitney Houston should be marrying Bobby Brown. And I was like, oh, know who Whitney Houston is, don't know who Bobby Brown is. Like, I cannot participate in this conversation. And so it was at first very isolating because there was so much that I didn't know.
I mean, how were you able to, you know, how were you treated as a result of not being able to?
Yeah, I got called an Oreo quite a bit, right, which means I am Black on the outside but white on the inside. And I was asked a lot, why do I talk white?
Right.
And, you know, I think there are a lot of Black kids or now adults who have experienced that. And the truth is, for me, it wasn't like my feelings weren't hurt so much as I was like, dang, I'm not doing a good job of covering this up.
Right.
I'm trying so hard and it's not working.
Well, I mean, that's always the weird thing, right, when you're a person of color, because on on one hand, it's like you're always seen as a person of color, and then all of a sudden you're being called white, and it's like, you know,
right,
it would be useful at times if that was true.
Right.
But it is not.
I'm like, I understand the question and I don't have a good answer. But I'm so glad that while I was in Cleveland, there was another little girl who lived like four houses down from my mom.
Yeah.
And she took me under her wing. And so she would listen to the radio station with me, and she had all the cool magazines, and she probably taught me more about boys than my mother would have liked. But it was really, really wonderful to finally have someone who was willing to teach me as opposed to just like count me out because I didn't know.
I'm Hari Kondabolu. I'm speaking with Austin Channing Brown about her book, I'm Still Here, Her Powerful Account of Growing Up Black, Christian, and Female in Middle-Class White America. I'd like to get into some definitions, just because you do use a lot of terms and you define them in ways that maybe other people wouldn't.
Sure.
The word racist, for example, I mean, certainly there's multiple understandings of that word. You say that it's problematic in reserving the word racist only for mean-spirited acts. Why is that?
Sure. To be clear, mean-spirited acts of discrimination, definitely racist.
Right.
Just not limited to racist. So anytime white culture really believes that it is the best, it is the superior, it is all-knowing, it is right, absolutely, and then creates policy around that, you've just engaged in racism.
Right.
And I think it's really hard for people to really grab a hold of the concept of power. And that's really what most people of color are speaking about when they speak about institutions. They're talking about the use of power.
I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting because I feel like I am caught in that space often because, you know, we see, you know, this definition of racism being this thing that is embedded into America is institutional. You know, the idea that people of color cannot be racist because we don't have power in a situation. And I definitely understand that on a theoretical level, and I agree with it. However, I feel like whenever the word racist is used in that way, it's very confusing for people because it is used like on a day-to-day level to mean discrimination. That person, regardless of race, was racist against me. So, I mean, do you feel like it's, you know, how do you navigate that when it's important to have this greater understanding of how racism is embedded in America's institutions, the way it runs, and at the same time, to use it colloquially? Like, how do you navigate that?
Right. So typically, I only talk about race and racism in spaces that I have chosen to talk about race or racism.
Right.
So having like a 5-minute conversation about is not going to get the job done.
Right.
So there will be no standing in line at the coffee shop and like trying to unpack this for someone.
Right.
It really does require time and intention. And that's why I choose to teach about it. So you have to show up to the class. You know, you got to come to the conference. You have to choose to be in a space where you're going to really dig into this for some length of time in order to understand. And I think that time is necessary.
You mentioned the idea of, you know, white superiority. And I think that really leads perfectly into this question, also about definition. You write mm-hmm. that white supremacy even invades programs aimed at seeking racial reconciliation. Now, can you explain this idea a bit more fully? And before that, when we say white supremacy in this context, do you like mean KKK or white supremacist organizations, or more the pervasive notion that underpins so many of our institutions that
right.
you know, the historical prioritization of white bodies?
You got it. And in fact, I love the way you phrase that. Yes, the second one. Because so many of our like trainings, workshops, like spaces where we're really trying to work this out, right? Trying to find some harmony, still prioritizes white feelings or how white people feel about it. So the training wasn't successful unless all the white folks were converted to understanding racial justice, or it wasn't successful unless they enjoyed it, or it wasn't successful unless they give their stamp of approval. Right. And so it becomes this like really weird, awkward space, or it can be. It doesn't have to be, but it can be a really strange, awkward space where white people are still being prioritized as opposed to putting the issues on the table and figuring out how we can work together on the issues.
So, like, you know, for example, white standards of beauty, you know, what is a default American in most people's eyes? What is mm-hmm. normal? You're saying those are all the places where white supremacy is clearly present. And also in terms of, you know, valuing white bodies and minds, it's like...
That's right.
It's as if the learning experience is only on one side of it. Diversity
That's
only is
right.
valuable because white people are learning from diversity versus the experience of the people of color who are quote-unquote the diversity.
And we just can't continue to work like that because it's still undermining the value of people of color, right? And that's the whole problem with racism. And so when we do that, we have to learn how to start centering people of color in the conversation, centering our experiences and expecting white people to do the hard work, whether they like it or not, like whether they right. enjoy it or not. And to say this was a successful training if people of color left feeling empowered, if people of color left feeling like their story was told, if people of color want to come back and do it again, like that is success.
I mean, if we're going to be talking about equality and justice, it feels like the language we use and our method for discussing it should also have that equality and justice embedded in it.
That's right.
Why do you think white people are afraid of naming our U.S. history as racist? And why do you think that's crucial, that has to be acknowledged?
Yeah, I don't know why. I think because it's uncomfortable.
Right.
I think it's really simple. It's just not comfortable. And I think there's this like pervasive notion that people of color really enjoy visiting, like revisiting our American history, not realizing it is painful for us too. Like this is not something we do for fun.
Right.
It is something we do because we realize the importance of knowing our history.
Right.
And the truth is, America understands this too, because the flag, because we all know the name George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, and because there are monuments all over D.C., right? Like, it's not that America actually believes that not knowing history is okay.
Right.
It just chooses to only know what is comfortable, and often only chooses to know what lifts up whiteness as opposed to acknowledging all the things that have not gone so well in our American history.
I'm Hari Kundabolu. I'm speaking with Austin Channing Brown about her book, I'm Still Here, her powerful account of growing up Black Christian and female in middle-class white America. You're listening to Midday in WNYC. We'll We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back. I'm Hari Kondabolu. I'm speaking with Austin Channing Brown about her new book, I'm Still Here. Austin, I want to talk more about the personal once again. You write in your book that harmony, the absence of outright conflict, often leaves deeper complications untouched. First of all, what does that mean? And also, you write about an experience in high school that illuminated this idea. So can you also explain what that experience was?
Yeah, the truth is I couldn't have explained it until I experienced it. So I'm going to start with a story, actually.
Sure, sure.
So I was in a religion class with a teacher that I adored. Whole school adored her. She was a nun, and she used four-letter words, and so we were very excited about that. And one day we walked into her classroom, when the semester had changed over. And she said, "You all can sit anywhere." And we were shocked because we had had a seating chart for the entire first semester. And she said, "Okay, now that you're all settled, I have a confession to make. I'm racist." And we were like, "Say what?" Yeah. "What just happened here?" And she was like, "I realized that as I've been making seating charts, I've been very aware of students' names and trying to separate black students." And she said there was she had a new class, and she says she couldn't figure it out based on names. And so she walked into a classroom, and there were two black girls sitting next to each other. And when she saw them, her first thought was, "Oh no, they're going to be so disrespectful and sassy. We're not going to get anything done in this class." And she stopped mid-thought and went, "Oh my gosh." And so she walked into all of her classes that day, apparently, or the next day, and decided that she was no longer going to have a seating chart because she realized she was using it not so that she could learn kids' names, or she was using it to try to, quote unquote, control black students.
I mean, that's gutsy, and that's what you mean by the absence of outright conflict. I mean, if she had not made that adjustment, people might not have noticed it, or at a certain point you get used to it becomes internalized.
Absolutely.
And she wasn't going to let that happen again.
That's right. And I really appreciate, I think this is another example too of power, in that she had the power, right, to create a seating chart.
Right.
And instead of, when she realized that she was using her power in a way that was reinforcing her own bias, she chose to stop using that power. And so, yeah, it was a really interesting moment for me. It raised a lot of questions in terms of, are there other teachers who are worried about, you know, me being sassy and disrespectful? I really like this teacher. Are there other teachers that I like,
right,
who also hold racial bias? It was a little weird, but I was grateful that she made that confession and that she decided to stop doing it.
I mean, it's amazing because I remember seeing teachers outside of the classroom, like walking around in a mall or a supermarket and being freaked out about that. The idea right. of like, the oh, you mean the all-knowing has to buy toilet paper? And meanwhile, right. you're telling me, and you know, your teacher walked in and started with, "I'm a racist." Like, oh, I couldn't even imagine what that would feel like.
I remember just like looking around the room, like no part of my body moved except my head.
Right.
what is happening right now? It was a good moment.
You describe another teacher giving your class a poem to read titled "We Wear the Mask" by Paul Laurence Dunbar, and how you didn't want to be the one to explain the poem to your classmates to give them, you write, quote, "access to such a vulnerable place." What did you mean by that? And why did you assume that you would be the one who had to explain it?
Yeah, I think it's not an uncommon experience for students of color who are just one of a handful, or maybe even the only one in their classroom, to be expected to teach the entire classroom and the teacher about race. And it can be really awkward because all black people don't have a community meeting every Wednesday where we decide how we feel about any given issue, you know?
Right.
Beyoncé did not call me before she dropped Becky and LeMay. You know, I didn't get that phone call.
Right.
She did not ask me if that was okay. And so, by the way, it's fine, Beyoncé. And so trying to speak on behalf of all people of color about how we feel or how we experience the world just feels unfair. And it's too much weight. And you know what also is unfair about it is that the teacher should have to be more brave than the students.
Mm.
And so to ask a student to be brave and to wade into a conversation about race and the teacher is unwilling to do that, I think is just wholly unfair.
Also, it seems so ridiculous in terms of, you know, teachers have all these qualification standards mm-hmm. and they come off as experts in all these things because I have this level of understanding. And meanwhile, when it comes to issues of race, what do you think, 12-year-old, who is not qualified to talk about this outside of personal experience?
It's just mind-boggling that would be such a pervasive experience for students of color. So I was grateful when Mr. Slavinsky embedded it into the curriculum because there were so many teachers who didn't do that. And it made me trust him more, quite honestly, even though I still didn't necessarily want to share with my all-white class about whether or not I personally was wearing a mask. That felt really vulnerable in that moment. I was still grateful, though. I was still grateful that he made them wrestle with Black history, that he made them inquire about this Black author of this poem, that he made them ask questions about what it meant and to dig into it, which I assume he would have done even if I hadn't been in that class, right?
Right.
That he just genuinely thought knowing this poem was important for all students. My trust in him grew so much that day.
I'm Hari Kundabolu. I'm speaking with Austin Channing Brown about her book, I'm Still Here. I mean, I feel like what you just said also speaks to the idea that learning, you are also in that classroom to learn and
That's
to participate
right.
and not to,
That's right.
to teach others alone.
Yeah, and my parents can do a little something at home, you
right.
know?
Sure,
my parents
sure,
are capable
sure,
of
sure.
teaching me something, you know?
Right.
But yeah, it's so nice to walk into a classroom and be able to learn about myself and learn about my history and for it to be considered important for everyone to know.
Who was Professor McMath? I mean, you talk a lot about how your various teachers in your life, clearly, like the importance of teachers who are trained and thoughtful with these things, because you talk about the importance of Professor McMath. Can you tell us how she helped you define yourself within the context of a large university space?
Yes. So Professor McMath was my first Black teacher. And she was my professor in college. So I had gone my entire educational career without ever having another Black teacher until I met her. And students of color often learn to translate white culture before white folks even realize they have one. And so, for example, I remember being a kid and hearing teachers try to give examples of things we should be doing daily. And, you know, like you brush your teeth daily, you know, you should work on your homework daily, you should do things daily. And they would throw out, wash your hair daily. And I remember thinking, nope, that ain't one. That's not universal.
Right.
I should not do that. My hair will fall out if I wash it daily. That's not good. But students of color, when those moments happen, just sort of let it pass, right? Like, we understand, we know white culture, and so it's not a big deal. Well, the first time I was in Professor McMath's class, the same thing happened for all the white students, and they were so lost, and I could have fallen out my seat and we were talking about business plans and marketing, and she decided to use a beauty shop as an example. And she said, so, you know, you might price a relaxer at, you know, like $50 or $60. And everyone in the class was like,
what's a relaxer?
What?
Right.
And she just kept going like they should all know what it was. She's like, you know, a relaxer. And she was like, wait, you all don't know what a relaxer is? And I was just like, see, this is how it feels.
Right.
This is how you all have felt your whole lives. You all just intrinsically understand what the teacher is saying. And now I get to have that moment.
Right.
So it passed, you know, she explained what it was. And everyone in the class was like, oh, okay. And she moved on with her lesson, right?
Right.
No big race conversation, no, you know, uproar. But it was so wonderful to finally be the one to understand the cultural nuances of a conversation.
You describe a school trip that was called Sankofa, which involved visiting a museum dedicated to the history of lynching, which is one of the big political issues of its day, which still doesn't get talked about very much, which is strange to me. But what were some of the other students' reactions after visiting the museum, and what does Sankofa mean? And what was the impact this trip had on you to get more involved with activism?
Sure. So Sankofa is a 3-day bus trip back then, it's changed a little bit now, but at that point, a white student and a black student would partner up, and for the entire bus trip, as we visited the South, you were expected to sort of unpack things with your partner. And so we went to a plantation first, and then we left the plantation. It was a mess. If you're interested, read the book, because it was a mess. And then we went to a museum that was about 4 rooms. It was a traveling exhibit, and every room was filled with photos of lynchings. And our group was about 40 people, and it was silent. It was dead silent, because not only were the photos just heart-wrenching, but next to every photo was a description of what happened. And so the descriptions would read, like, this man was accused of stealing, you know, a quarter from the store or something, and he was lynched for it. And in some cases, obviously, they knew that it was false. And so if they knew that for certain, then that would be included in the description. And I think it stunned us, because all the black students were walking through this thinking, is that one of my family members? Mm. Did this happen in my family? Is this why my family moved north? Is this why we're not in the South anymore? And I think the white students were silent because, like we talked about earlier, they were being confronted with an uncomfortable part of history. Because what I didn't know until I walked through that museum was that lynchings were like a community happy event. Mm. I think I always assumed that they were done in quiet, like in the dark of night, and never talked about again. Right. And I walked through and I saw a postcard that had a lynching on the front, and on the back it said, sorry we missed you at the barbecue last night.
It was like a carnival, a street carnival. Something.
I mean, photos being taken,
right.
Body parts being taken.
Right.
It astounded me that it wasn't just lynching. Right? It was lynching with happy faces.
It was a community event. It was something that brought the community together, the killing of a black person.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe it.
I mean, I think it also, you know, talking about your classmates' reactions, can you talk about the idea of white fragility? Because I feel like I hear that phrase more and more, and I don't always think people know what that means. What is white fragility?
Yeah, so there are like really good, fantastic, like for real definitions, and I'm not going to give you one of those. I think what's easier to understand for those who have been in a room where the purpose is to talk about race or racial diversity or the history of race, right? And I think we've all watched it happen, where a white person, often a white man, will stand up and say, I actually had this happen once, will stand up and say, I disagree with what you're saying. I disagree. I just looked this up on Wikipedia.
Oh.
And I know, terrible, right? But there's this inability to just sit in the discomfort. And the emotions become so fragile that there is a need to, for lack of a better word, explode.
Right.
And for some white folks, it's aggression, right? It's standing up. It's becoming aggressive. It's yelling. For some folks, it's just crying uncontrollably and recentering the conversation on them. So we were talking about, let's say, lynching. And then all of a sudden, a white person in the group will go, but I just didn't know. I wasn't here. And now all of a sudden, instead of talking about lynching, right, we're talking about the feelings of this one white person in the room.
I always felt white fragility was different, because I think all humans are fragile in different ways.
Yeah.
But I think white fragility is fascinating to me, because it's the fragility that comes out of power. It's the fragility that comes out of, like, you've built all these muscles because of power, and there's certain things you've neglected. So when you're hitting those places, you break. Because you were in a position of power and not vulnerability for so long. You don't know what it's like to be in the position of seeing other people's vulnerability or you yourself feeling vulnerable.
That's right. And so the resiliency for those hard conversations is so low that the white person has to find an escape.
What does racial reconciliation mean to you, and what does it get confused with? I mean, I think we've never had that in this country. Maybe in South Africa there's been attempts at it, certainly, but we've never had that. So what does it look like to you?
Yeah, the truth is I have no idea. I wish I had some, like, really, really good examples.
Right.
The truth is I don't know that we know yet. But it's, you know, the word reconciliation can often be a rather churchy word.
Right.
I think more often we hear the words like racial justice or anti-racism work, you know. But because I move in and out of sort of church circles so often, reconciliation is a word that I hear quite a bit. And it often gets confused for, or at least it gets exchanged for words like diversity or harmony or a whole lot of other words. And I think my major point to churches who choose to use this word, and I'm not an advocate for it necessarily, but if you do, I want to just say that reconciliation should be revolutionary, that it should not be a stand-in for going to get coffee together. It should be trying to figure out how to embody this self-declaration, right? The church's self-declaration that we are one body. If we really believed that, then reconciliation would look different in the church.
Before we go, I just want to quickly say that we're getting a lot of pushback on Twitter saying that we're being racist towards white people. And I just want to let all the white people who are listening know that rest of our guests are white. And most of the guests this week are, I think, also going to be white. So we'll make sure we create a safe space after this interview. Thank you so much for joining me, Austin. Just honestly, a fantastic interview. I'm speaking with Austin Channing Brown about her book, I'm Still Here.